Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. The Mars rover Curiosity touched down safely late Sunday night or early Monday morning, depending where you were. Thousands worldwide looked on. Curiosity will now get to work investigating whether or not Mars has had a climate hospitable to life. We'll celebrate this monumental engineering success and look ahead to the science to come with the University of Utah Assistant Professor of Physics and Astronomy, Tabitha Mueller. Kent Tabiska, who's worked at Jet Propulsion Laboratory and is now director of Utah State University Space Weather Center, and former NASA employee and current USU Associate Professor of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering, Stephen Whitmore. Then the BLM has ruled in favor. The Goshute tribe is very much opposed, and one Nevada official says that state may need to sue Utah for a proposed water project to transport water from eastern Nevada to a water-thirsty Las Vegas area. We'll unravel all of the ins and outs with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Christopher Smart in the second half. And we'll be talking with University of Utah Assistant Professor of Physics and Astronomy, Tabitha Mueller. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We appreciate you with me. Director of Utah State University Space Weather Center and former Jet Propulsion Laboratory employee, Kent Tabiska. Thanks for coming in. And also with us is former NASA employee and current USU Associate Professor of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering, Stephen Whitmore. Thanks for coming in.
Glad to be here.
So let's start with Professor Mueller. I believe you were at the event at University of Utah, somewhat 250 people or so watching that that event. What was the mood there as the successful touchdown happened?
I was all suspense and excitement. And it was sort of a festival atmosphere. We played video game simulations of the Mars rover landing, and we ate Mars bars and watched the live feed, and everyone was very tuned into the live feed. It was very exciting.
I believe there are events kind of like this all over the world. This really touched a chord.
There were, and I believe NASA had a website that directed people to different events in their areas.
I believe, Professor Whitmore, you were in Alabama.
Yeah, I was just coming back from Huntsville, Alabama at the Marshall Space Flight Center. So I'd gotten off the plane about an hour earlier and rushed home, and I dialed into the NASA Digital Learning Network, which is actually one of their feeds that actually allows you to get inside access. So, and then I also had the TV on, so I was double covered for the,
and
the suspense.
Dr. Tabiska, I assume you were tuned in.
Actually, I caught the last end of it. We're smack in the middle of doing the forecasting of when these large solar storms hit the Earth. We've got a deadline coming up in a couple of days, and so we've been really plugging on that. But I was able to catch the last part of it, and it was absolutely thrilling. They've done a fantastic job.
Mm. Professor Whitmore, let me ask you about this engineering achievement. How hard is this, and what kind of odds do you think there were that this would actually be successful?
Well, anytime you do something as complicated as this, there's no way to really rehearse this. There's a couple of aspects of this. First, it's the microgravity on Mars, 2/5 gravity, so there's no way to simulate that on Earth. And then, of course, the dynamics of reentry. Planetary entry on Mars is approximately Mach 38, which is about 38 times the speed of sound. And by contrast, if you think about it, when the space shuttle reenters, from low Earth orbit, it's about 25 times the speed of sound. So the amount of energy that has to dissipate when it actually does a direct entry on Mars is huge. And then you have to go through a sequence of events. You've got to basically be able to slow down to have a supersonic parachute deployment, which is about twice the speed of sound when it deploys. And then because the Mars atmosphere is so thin, they have to actually use a rocket for descent because the terminal velocity, in other words, the velocity where the drag of the parachute equals the pull of gravity on Mars, is since it's about 150 miles an hour, that rocket actually has to slow this thing to almost zero velocity. And then because of the delicate sensors on that vehicle, they didn't want to actually touch down all the way to the surface because of the dust kick-up. And so basically this is what's almost circus-like, is that it had to hover about, I think it was 25 meters off of the ground, and then a big crane or a rope, sort of like when you see a helicopter that hovers and then lowers something to the ground, actually had to lower the lander to the ground, then it had to release. And I mean, a sequence of events like that is remarkable. And remember, it all had to happen robotically because there's no way to send commands. Mm. It's about 16 minutes for a signal to reach from Earth to Mars right now. So the fact that it was all done with pre-programmed control is remarkable.
Yeah, yeah. That is amazing. Dr. Topiska, you worked at JPL.
Yes. Well, in the 90s, for that decade, I was an instrument scientist on the Galileo mission out of Jupiter. And one of the things that came out of that mission was the understanding that the second moon out from Jupiter, Europa, is an entirely ice-covered moon. It's got about 100 kilometers of water at the surface. From the mid-90s up to now, in the science community, we really now started looking at this, not only the search for water on other planets, but how that is related to life. And in addition to Mars, there's, of course, Europa, where we also think there may be a possibility of life existing now, whether they're bacteria-like things or fish-like things in this deep water ocean. But just as a comment that you had said, Steve, which is a really a follow-on, the sequence of events that you outlined for having to make this successful Mars mission is, and the fact that they actually were successful in completing that, is a great precursor to what has to happen for a mission to Europa, where you basically have to take the same size of spacecraft. It's about the size of a large kitchen table. You land it on a surface. It has to, in Europa, it has to drill down through about 5 miles of rock-hard ice to then insert a submarine type of vehicle to search for fish-like stuff or bacteria or whatever. So it's really an amazing experience that we're on as a species, searching for life off of our planet.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, NASA actually had a project that was on the books at the early part of this decade, or of the last decade, called JIMO, Jupiter Icy Moons Observer. And unfortunately, it got hacked by budget cuts, but I think you may see that come back. Mm-hmm. But in talking about water, it's really interesting because when the astronauts brought the rocks back from the moon, they found that the rocks were completely anhydrous. That is, there's no water at all in it. And so we assumed that water was not very common. And then in the late 90s, the Navy, Naval Research Lab, sent a probe to the moon called Clementine. And Clementine was really, it was kind of a technology project testing out sensors that the Navy needed for stuff other than obviously science. The Navy needed to observe stuff under the water, under the ocean. And one of the things that Clementine sent back was signatures for extremely large amounts of ice and water near the poles of the moon. And in response to that, NASA sent a mission called LRO, Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, and LCROSS, which was basically a probe that impacted on the moon. I think it was 2008. And what they've discovered is that the moon also has entire oceans of ice the size of like Lake Huron on the southern poles. So it's turning out that the potential for life and certainly the building blocks is a lot more common than we thought just 20 years ago. So it'll be really interesting to see if the signatures will show up on this particular probe, because if we find that water is ubiquitous, I think we're going to find that probably life is also going to be ubiquitous at some point.
If you just joined us, we're talking about the Mars rover Curiosity. It landed safely Sunday night, Monday morning, and now a lot of good science we're expecting to come out of this. If you'd like to make a comment on this or ask a question of our guests, you're certainly welcome to do so. 1-800-826-1495 is the number. We have another 15 minutes left on this subject. 1-800-826-1495, toll free. Or you can email us at upraxcess@gmail.com, upraxcess@gmail.com. Professor Beeler, this is the whole reason, isn't it, that we're exploring out there? We're wondering if we're alone in the universe. We're looking for life.
We are, and I think it's just part of human nature to be searching for life and also just exploring how it is our solar system formed and how it is, what the history of our universe is like.
I heard the acronym MSL, I think it was. It's some of the scientists were not calling it Curiosity, standing for Mars Science Laboratory. This is pretty impressive. What this rover is going to be able to do? What tell us a little bit about what it will be doing?
It has a large arsenal of instruments. That the special thing about this rover is that it carries equipment to gather samples of rocks and soil, and then it can process them and distribute it to onboard test chambers that it has right there, and it can analyze samples right there and send us back information about them.
And the expected life is 2 years, but we've had other rovers that have far exceeded their life, so this could be years and years to come.
Absolutely. Spirit and Opportunity were just great success stories, only supposed to be lasting for about 3 months, but 6 years later, Opportunity is still going.
So in the next few months, as the rover gets going, what are you most curious to learn?
I'm curious to see more of the Martian landscape, and I think it will be several months before they start sending back analysis of different samples. But it will be fun to see more of the Martian landscape and see the early digging that they're able to do and testing out the instrumentation, seeing how everything works.
Dr. Tabiska, this, I believe, the photos of all the scientists jumping up and down, I think that was at JPL, wasn't it?
That's correct, yeah.
And so you've probably been in that control center. You could probably relate to that jubilation. This was high stakes, wasn't it? In a climate of budget cuts, and this is, I don't know, $2 or $3 billion. If that had crashed, I don't know what would have happened.
Absolutely. Well, over in building 264 JPL, that's the large admin building, but the whole bottom floor is the control center that you saw on the news clips, and the amount of effort of the MSL team, the Curiosity engineers, they've been working on this for almost a decade now, trying to pull this together, and I think it was instructive some of the comments that some of the science community said. You know, before the thing happened, they said that, you know, if this is a failure, we're going to pick up and we're going to go on again. And I think, Tabitha, the comment you made, which is that we, as a human species, we are curious and we want to find out what's going on. We always face setbacks at different times. But this happened to be a time when it was not a setback. We, in fact, have made a tremendous amount of progress with this landing.
I wonder, having worked at NASA, Professor Whitmore, that's again, you know some of these emotions, and this is decades of work by hundreds and thousands of people.
I didn't work on JPL based probes. I worked on NASA stuff, but I worked on quite a few X-planes, and we used to call that being X-planed in your life, where that was all you did. You know, you essentially got up at sunrise and came back at sunset, and you saw many sunrises, not very many sunsets. You were indoors during that time, but it does tend to emotionally drain you because of the level of commitment. In the thing that you got to remember about these Mars missions is, Mars is an incredibly long way from home, and so there's no way to actually do one-to-one interactions. So the mission team basically has to be very conservative in what they do. So they analyze their data sets, and then based upon those data sets, they will run through a whole suite of ground-based simulations. Their next response, they will actually do a series of pre-programmed commands on the ground simulations to see what the response of the vehicle will be, and so forth. And then they have to package that into a little tiny command that then they send over about 160 million miles. It's called an iload, and then the spacecraft will receive that message, and then it will execute that command. And that's why it actually takes so long for stuff to happen, because there's no way you could actually drive this rover directly. They have to go, okay, I want to go to this rock over here. They have to spend a long time programming that and actually do it. The Russian sonde program their little rover that they actually were driving around on Mars in the 1970s terminated when one of the Martian controllers got drunk and decided to drive it around and drove it into a big crater. So,
oh no!
So we're a little more careful than that.
Yeah, that's wow. That's a big mistake. Imagine
I suspect he ended up somewhere breaking rocks after that.
That guy got fired, I imagine. We're talking about the Mars rover Curiosity, a big success, engineering success, now hopefully a big science success to gather science from Mars, and we're all glued to the set, as it were. We're talking about this, and you're welcome to join the conversation at 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495, or an email to us at upraxis@gmail.com, upraxis@gmail.com. We're talking with Tabitha Beeler, who is Assistant Professor of Physics and Astronomy at University of Utah. We're talking with Director of Utah State University's Space Weather Center and a former JPL employee, Kent Tabiska, and a former NASA employee, current USU Associate Professor of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering, Stephen Whitmore. Back to you, Professor Beeler. The number one question is, can we find signs that life has happened or is it currently on Mars? What would that mean if we find such, which I guess would be probably microbial life, but that would be monumental. What would that mean?
It would be microbial life, probably, is what we would be looking for. It would just give us more incentive to look for more signs of life on Mars and then in other places like Europa, as was mentioned before.
What would, if you had the magic wand, could remake the U.S. space program? There have been budget cuts and so forth, and we've cut back on manned flight, gone to these automated rovers. Would you like to see bring back manned flight to Mars? What are your dreams?
I think manned flight to Mars would be very exciting and very inspirational. There's been talk of going back to the moon first to test things out. There are different things that need to be tested out, such as how much radiation astronauts would be exposed to on their way to Mars. And I think it makes sense to do a lot of that sort of testing first.
What would it take to do a manned flight to Mars?
I think radiation is a key component of it. Having humans survive not only a 6-month approximate journey out, some time on the surface, and then we presumably want them to return for another 6 months or so. There's a lot of exposure in the radiation environment. The two parts of the radiation environment that are important are the galactic cosmic ray background, which is persistent throughout, varies with solar cycle activity. And then the other major source are the big solar flares, the solar energetic proton events. So it's been kind of interesting to follow in our science community a lot of the peripheral activity that's going on related to the Mars mission. For example, the radiation detector on Curiosity. We're also looking at that to determine the general characteristics of how our sun's environment can stand off the galactic radiation environment. And that applies directly to things that we're working on. For example, here at Utah State, we're working on a project of helping monitor the radiation environment that then is applied to the commercial aviation that we as frequent flyers or pilots or aircrew feel every day. Environment globally characterizing it and getting the weather of it is critical not only for our day-to-day activity, but certainly for humans going to Mars. So radiation is going to be a big issue and how to deal with that potential problem is a big one.
What are some of the other difficulties?
Well, to follow up on the discussion that we just had, one of the big issues associated with going to Mars, radiation is such a problem, is because if you look at the International Space Station and all of all but just a few missions, the 8 missions that actually went to lunar orbit, is that they are inside the Earth's magnetosphere. Magnetosphere is basically that essentially the same thing that causes a magnet to actually deflect when and to show the magnetic field pointing north. But that magnetosphere has the effect of deflecting high energy radiation of particles from space. So when you're in low Earth orbit, you're underneath that magnetosphere and the astronauts are protected. That's why we can have astronauts on the International Space Station for up to 6 months with no problem. But when you leave low Earth orbit and you go to the moon or to Mars, then suddenly there's no way to actually protect that other than basically a very large amount of mass. And if you look at a round trip to the moon, is roughly a round trip mission is going to be about 3 years long, and the probability of having a high energy solar event that would actually cause damage to astronauts is very high, almost approaching one. Apollo 17 was actually scheduled to go to the moon in October of 1971 or 1972, and August of 72, and the mission got delayed until December. And it was a very good thing because actually during the period that Apollo 17 was scheduled to be on the moon, there was a huge solar flare, and the crew probably would not have survived that solar flare. And NASA knew that during Apollo. They were basically trying to do a mad dash to the moon and bring them back. We don't really have a good mechanism for actually protecting astronauts in deep space right now from high-energy solar events other than a large amount of mass. And the problem is you got to take that large amount of mass from Earth and take it up there, and we don't have the lift capacity right now to do that. So we're quite a few decades away from being able to go to Mars at this point, in my personal opinion.
Professor Beeler, this could have been a big failure. It was a big success, and I wonder if that perhaps will enable other projects that you have your eye on. And if so, what would those be? Do you think they'll don't have funding right now, but perhaps will because of this big success?
I think there are a lot of things. I mean, not only preparing to do more manned spaceflight and working, spending resources to work on these problems of radiation, but I think other research things as well, such as the James Webb Space Telescope and different projects like that.
I wonder about, I want to ask each of our guests about private space industry. We've had a success recently with, I keep forgetting the name, SpaceX, I think the company. I wonder what your view in this is. More and more of the load of the space exploration going to be taken by private companies, do you think?
Absolutely. I'll
absolutely
step in here.
Second.
Right, right. Full disclosure, I'm the president of a small company in the space environment technologies, but we have a very active space weather community that's private sector, and we're finding that particularly small businesses, but even some of the large organizations, are really at the cutting edge of being able to not only improve upon the kind of, in this case, the space environment and space weather forecasting than government labs are able to do, but I think that if we as a species are going to make it out in our evolution out into the stars and make use of the resources, the energy, minerals out in space to improve life on Earth, it means that we're going to have to learn how to work and develop activity out there, and that definitely means that we need to have a commercial sector, a private sector. We can't all pay for it out of our own tax money, and so we want that capability.
Yeah, actually, NASA just made a big award last Thursday for the what's called Commercial Crew Integration Program, or they call it CICAP. That is basically three contractors were given a Space Act agreement, SpaceX, which is in Southern California. That's Elon Musk, the inventor of PayPal, is actually that. Boeing has a project, and then a company out of Sparks, Nevada, called Sierra Nevada Corporation. And they were each given, I think, $400 million and $200 million, $400, $400, and $200, to actually develop an integrated system that actually can that's completely commercially funded. NASA basically just has oversight to lift crews into orbit. And I think you're going to find that one or two of those by 2016 will restore our capability to do that. So there's a big push in that direction, understanding that private industry is just more nimble. They can do things faster because they don't have to go through all the government procurement regulations, and they're not hostage to a yearly budget crisis that they have to go through, so they can do better long-term planning. So I think you're going to see that will be the way of the future with it.
Good. Will there always be a place for government money in this? For example, could a private company send Curiosity?
I don't think a private company could do Curiosity. You know, there is a role for government funding. And really, you know, we all realize and accept if it had not been for NASA's funding of the space program up through this point, which they've done an incredible job on, even with some failures here and there, we would not be where we're at. So there's both a public role and a private role. We've got to recognize that both hands have a role to play. There will always be a need for some kind of government funding. Yeah,
we just have about 3 or 4 minutes left in this segment. I want to end with this, starting with Professor Beeler. Just have you dream? That's part of this, isn't it? That's why we get into space exploration. What are some of your dreams you're looking for? Maybe, you know, sky's the limit, as it were.
The sky is the limit and beyond. I think that the space exploration inspires our younger generations to get involved in science and engineering, and everybody has dreams. And all the sciences are involved in space exploration now. I think biologists, physicists, chemists, geologists, Everybody plays a role in space exploration now.
And Professor Whitmore?
I would call, my dream would be the development of an economy of scale. There's a real potential for, especially in the communications market, to leverage space to do things that we do with terrestrial relays and so forth. So there's a real potential for, you know, basically corporations to make many, many billions of dollars in space. That money, as it's developed and then reinvested, starts to suddenly grow, where space now becomes, instead of the purview of a few very elite people sponsored by government, suddenly it becomes something that's within the access of common people. And my feeling is that within 100 years, especially with low Earth orbit, that the cost of access to space for individuals will be to where basically any average Joe once in a lifetime can do that.
That's a vacation.
Yeah.
That'd be great. Dr. Topisco, what's your dream?
Well, you know, 300 years from now, historians are going to look back on our two or three generations now alive, and they're going to say, did those guys help us move forward, or did they get involved in all whatever was going on at that point in history? As a species, we've always either escaped to new areas or learned how to survive in new ways. And as we grow in population numbers and complexity, we're going to be forced to look for other energy and mineral resources. The only logical place is to expand out into space. And to be able to use those resources really represents a huge potential in the growth for our human species. If we don't take that route, I think we're set for increasing wars over more and more restricted mineral resources. So in a sense, my dream is that in 300 years, you know, the historians will look back at us and say, those guys really were able to expand their opportunities so that we can make the resources of space available to those to better life on Earth. Mm.
Well, the Mars rover Curiosity is certainly helping us all to dream, expand our dreams. We're getting the high-resolution pictures. We'll be getting those back. And over the next several years, we'll be getting some, I'm sure, amazing science from Mars. We've been talking about this with Tabitha Beeler, who is Assistant Professor of Physics and Astronomy at University of Utah. Professor Beeler, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Kent Tabiska, Director of Utah State University's Space Weather Center. Thanks.
Thank you.
And USU Associate Professor of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering, Stephen Whitmore. Thanks.
Yeah, I was glad to be here.
Coming up, we're going to return to Earth. We'll be talking about water. Of course, that's a loaded topic in the West. And the latest news is Nevada might sue Utah over the Snake Valley Water Project. We're going to be talking about this, unraveling some of the mystery with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Christopher Smart. That's coming up after a break.
This is folk singer Michael Jonathan inviting you to tune in our next broadcast of Wood Songs. We have two great artists, Marty Rabin and the legendary Charlie McCoy. Both artists, music, and conversation on the next broadcast of the Wood Songs, Old Time Radio.
Friday night at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
Coming up on the next Bluegrass Breakdown, their music is otherworldly, Bible Belt noir, comic, intense, and tragic. Named after Kentucky Highway 41, the famed Dixie Beeline, they more than live up to their motto of sweet picked for freshness. I'm Dave Higgs, and the Dixie Beeliners will be letting the fur fly live on the next Bluegrass Breakdown.
Saturday night at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Did you know that students retain content from an informational text better than they do when the information is embedded in a story? Did you know that when students are rewarded for reading across a wide range of genres of texts, it has a positive impact on their attitude toward reading? When young children are given a choice of books to receive as a gift, they often favor informational books.
Did You Know That is made possible by the USU Emma Eccles Jones College of Education and Human Services. More at cehs.usu.edu.
Thanks for staying with us for Access Utah. In the second half, we return to Earth from Mars, and we're going to talk about water disputes. Yeah, this is a very loaded topic. We've been hearing about this for some time. And now, one Southern Nevada Water Authority official, that's the manager, Pat Mulroy, says that the Nevada should consider suing Utah, taking that to the Supreme Court to make them sign an agreement, which they have not signed, over water that's lying under Snake Valley. Snake Valley Aquifer. Snake Valley straddles the Utah-Nevada line. The BLM has approved or given further approval for that project, which would pump water from eastern Nevada and possibly western Utah down to the southern Nevada area, Las Vegas area, which is a growing area and very thirsty. There are a lot of ins and outs to this story, and it's just gotten more complicated. We thought we'd go to Salt Lake Tribune reporter Christopher Smart to help us with this. And Christopher Smart, welcome to Access Utah.
Thanks for having me.
So the headline, Snake Valley Water could land in the U.S. Supreme Court. Let's start there with that headline. Ms. Mulroy is suggesting, apparently, that if they have to, Nevada should take Utah to court.
This goes back quite a few years. Utah and Nevada began negotiating an agreement to split up Snake Valley groundwater, back in around 2005. That agreement was mandated by Congress, and Congress told the two states to go ahead and figure something out. And this was in sort of the planning stages of the Southern Nevada Water Authority's plan to pump groundwater from five basins in Nevada. And, of course, one of those is the Snake Valley, which is in both Utah and Nevada.
Now, apparently this is important enough to the project, the Snake Valley. I suppose Nevada could just leave Snake Valley out and go to the other four basins.
Well, what's interesting about this, Tom, is that the BLM came out with its final EIS on the Southern Nevada Water Authority proposal and did not include Snake Valley Water in that. But I think what we're being told, at least by the Las Vegas people, is that that's because they don't yet have right to that water. And the reason is because of this agreement with Utah hasn't been signed. The water engineer in Nevada, much like the water engineer in Utah, determines who has right to what water. And so what Nevada wants is for that agreement to be reached so that the state engineer can then rule on Nevada's application for water rights in Snake Valley, and at that point they would go back to the BLM and say, okay, now we have the water right, so now we want you to give us rights away across your land so we can pump and pipe that water down to Las Vegas.
But I suppose Nevada could just make this a lot simpler for itself and just say we're gonna drop Snake Valley from this project.
Right. But as you mentioned, Las Vegas is a very thirsty place. And this and Pat Morrow and her plan to pipe this water is a very aggressive plan, and it's a very expensive plan. In 2010 dollars, it's listed at about $15.5 billion, that's billion with a B, dollars to do this. So that's very expensive, and so it makes us ask the question, well, if you could do this tomorrow, would you? And I think the answer is probably no. But what they apparently are doing is looking down the pike 10 years, 20 years, and at that point, you know, of course, the project will be more expensive, most likely, but if the economy turns around, is $15 billion out of the picture for Las Vegas? Maybe, maybe not.
Maybe we're looking at our future, the picture of things to come, water wars. We're living in these are the two driest states, right?
And Arizona, and so when you go out to Snake Valley and those basins just east of Snake Valley near the Utah-Nevada line, what you see is a very dry country, and what you have out there are a handful of ranchers who have mostly small operations. They have to pump water, in most cases groundwater, to raise alfalfa. There's also the Goshute Indian tribe out there that also plays into this. So when you look at those folks out there, they don't have a lot of political pull, and they don't have a lot of money. When you look at Las Vegas, by contrast, you see a lot of political pull and a lot of money. So it's sort of a David and Goliath type of matchup here. And, nobody can predict how the climate will be in 10 to 20 years, but most likely it'll still be exceedingly dry out there. And that gives environmentalists and the ranchers pause if without water, you know, they could just simply literally dry up and blow away.
Just joined us. We're talking about a proposed water project which would pump water from eastern Nevada, and if Snake Valley ends up being included in this, from parts of western Utah, Snake Valley straddles the state line, to very thirsty Las Vegas. And in fact, the latest is Pat Mulroy, the manager of Southern Nevada Water Authority, has suggested that if it comes to that, Nevada should consider taking Utah to court, to the Supreme Court, over an agreement which was never signed by Utah. If you want to join this conversation, we'd love to have you with your question or comment. 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495, or email us at upraxcess@gmail.com, upraxcess@gmail.com. Our guest for this part of the program is Salt Lake Tribune reporter Christopher Smart, who's been covering this story. Of course, on the other side of this, Mr. Smart, I've heard Nevada officials give reassurances that they've done studies or seen studies that that those aquifers, that water is going to be okay. They're not going to overdraw that water.
Yeah, and I think that that's the big question, because there are studies that both sides point to as backing up, you know, their reasons for doing it or their reasons for not wanting it done. And I think in the final analysis, there's a big question mark about how much water is in those aquifers, number one, and number two, how they are recharged, at what rate, because if you're pumping water out faster than it's recharging, then, of course, sooner or later you're going to deplete them completely. Nevada and Utah sat down and they pondered this over a 3 or 4 year period. In 2009, they reached an agreement. But I think it appears as though when Utah left the bargaining table, they weren't too happy, or at least not completely satisfied. So Governor Gary Herbert, for the past 3 years, says he's been, you know, further analyzing this. He doesn't want to sign off until he's absolutely sure that this will not harm Utah ranchers like Cecil Garland. Well, Cecil Garland has been out in Snake Valley going on 40 years, but, you know, before that he was sort of an environmental specialist with the federal government. He's been in tune with these things all along. He's fearful that what they plan would drain the aquifer faster than it gets recharged, and therefore, you know, leave this dust bowl idea. What Nevada wants to do is put in their pumps in Snake Valley on the Nevada side of Snake Valley and pump groundwater there. What Cecil Garland fears is that it doesn't matter where you pump that aquifer. If you're pumping from the Nevada side of the line, it would still draw down water under his alfalfa field. So the Utahns have been very slow about this. Now the folks in Nevada are saying, well, you know, you have to get off the dime. If you won't, we'll sue you. We'll take it to the Supreme Court, which has original jurisdiction on this matter. But what we don't know is, is this something that they're actually going to do, or is it, you know, something of a saber rattling to get Utah to move one direction or the other?
If Nevada were to take Utah to the Supreme Court, what would be the legal theory? It's the Congress mandated that we get an agreement. We had an agreement, but you just didn't sign it. Would that be the basis?
Yeah, that's basically it. I don't think, I'm no lawyer, of course, and these things do get complex quickly, but I don't think Nevada has to show that anything except that Congress mandated the agreement. Utah hasn't done so. I think that that's just the short and simple of it. Of course, you know, these things these things can get dragged out. I think, though, in the end, and I think that, you know, this is something that has come out today, is that, you know, Nevada is saying, Las Vegas, the Southern Nevada Water Authority folks are saying, you know, if Utah wants a different agreement, then, you know, we'll renegotiate another agreement. But they just can't do nothing. They can't have this sort of pocket veto where everything comes to a standstill. Having said that, the state water engineer had said that he would not rule on the water rights in Snake Valley for 10 years after the 2009 agreement. So you can see that this is something that is going to take a while to play out. But the stakes, nonetheless, are very high.
Hmm. And the governor, I guess he's what he's saying is we need to study this further. What is this, foot dragging? Or do you think he's generally against this, going to decide against this in the end?
You know, it's hard to know. I think a lay person might think, well, you know, you've had 3 years since you came to the terms of the agreement. You were in negotiations for 4 or 5 years before that. There's all this data out there. You know, how long does it take? But there are things going on behind the scenes. We don't know. We don't know what all the motivations are. And so I think that the people in Utah generally, the sense I get is that they really don't like the idea of Nevada taking what little water is out there. On the other hand, as I mentioned earlier, the folks out in the West Desert, there are not a lot of them, and they don't have a lot of political pull, and they're certainly not wealthy.
And this is, you described this as David and Goliath. I know from some reporting we've done here at UPR, the Goshutes definitely are not happy. They feel they've been bypassed in the planning here.
Yeah, and so they're, you know, going to weigh in on this as a tribe. And, of course, they are out there. They have a reservation at the foot of the Deep Creek Mountains, which is that beautiful granite range that is right on the Utah-Nevada border. But they are a sovereign nation. But like the ranchers out there, there aren't very many of them, and they don't have a lot of money. I think that I'm not sure if their legal standing would be above that of the ranchers because they're a sovereign nation. But in the end, they would have to rely on the same scientific analysis that is at the base of the argument. And as far as the Nevada water engineer is concerned, he will make that determination, but it won't be for a while. And whether there's more information about these underground aquifers by then, perhaps there will be. But it's a tricky science, knowing how much water is beneath the surface out there. And, of course, it varies from year to year. We're hearing that, you know, this year, because it's been so dry and because there are several new wells in Snake Valley, that the groundwater levels seem to be lower than usual. So there are a lot of questions to be answered yet.
Just have a couple minutes left. Finally, I want to get your take on this. In past, it's been dams and reservoirs. Now, lately, it seems all we're hearing is pipelines. I wonder if that's what we've come to. We're getting desperate for water.
Yes, and there's we live in this out here in the West, particularly the Southwest. We're in an arid area, and it's also an area that's been booming in population because people seem to like dry, warm climates, and so we've seen this great growth in places like St. George and Las Vegas. What environmentalists are saying now is that the future for this region may be desalinization of ocean water. And so they're pointing to that as saying, you know, by the time that Southern Nevada Water Authority gets ready to do this, it's likely that a better solution might be pumping water from the West Coast to Las Vegas, either before or after they take the salt out of it. So that, you know, maybe that's the future. It's hard to know, but there's really only so much water, you know, either coming down the Colorado or melting from snow in the mountains that finds its way into these underground aquifers. So, you know, it's a fairly finite system.
Well, we'll leave it there, and I'm sure that as you've outlined it there, given the need for water, you'll be covering water. We'll be reading about it into the future. Christopher Smart, Salt Lake Tribune reporter, has been talking about Snake Valley and Eastern Nevada pipeline project. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
And we're going to end the program with a commentary. Before that, let me tell you about tomorrow. Tomorrow I'll be at the Utah Rural Summit. They're celebrating their 25th anniversary. That's in Cedar City. We'll be talking with Jack Schultz with his Boomtown USA ideas and other guests live from Cedar City tomorrow. Hope you'll join me then. Thanks for listening today.
Commentator Thad Boggs.
Once again, Utah ranks last in the amount we spend per child on teachers and assistants. We are a proud state and the richest country in the world. Utah schools are only slightly above average in an average country. That is not acceptable. Every parent should be outraged, and every patriot should demand that we better educate our people. Education comes in many packages. Some teach youngsters about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Others offer advanced degrees that unravel the secrets of our universe. Education at all levels makes the human condition better. It is something that we can do together that we cannot do individually. It is an investment, not an expense. A poorly educated person is a costly mistake. Providing free public education for each child to reach her potential offers a path toward economic recovery and national security. The world's largest economy cannot afford uneducated people. A safe and prosperous world depends on making our children our top priority. Recently, I stopped at the outdoor amphitheater on Utah State University campus. I looked across our valley and thought about the hundreds of graduates who received diplomas there. Then I heard happy sounds coming from elementary children jogging up the hill. Laughing, shouting kids of all colors were led by a smiling teacher up the hill, down through the amphitheater, and up again. A teacher said, "We're the fourth grade from Adams School, out for a vigorous walk." Vigorous, educated kids are our future. Unfortunately, we have not made them our highest priority. With our riches, we can give all children within our borders the best free public education in the world. Taxes for improving people and community pay big dividends. If the wealthiest country in the world cannot make developing people its top priority, we will stew in ignorance while others lead. Shame on us if we let that happen. This is Thad Boggs.
Support for Access Utah comes from the Utah Humanities Council, enriching cultural, intellectual, and civic life by providing opportunities for all Utahns to explore life's most engaging questions and the wonders of the human experience.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.
On the next Putumayo World Music Hour, we'll dance the tango in its many forms, from the traditional bandoneon of Argentina to the pulsing electronica of the new tango of Finland and Norway. I'm Rosalie Howarth. Join me for Tango Around the World, the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Friday night at 10 o'clock on Utah Public Radio.
Did you know that nearly half of preschool children in the U.S. do not go outside to play every day? And parents are less likely to take their daughters outside to play than their sons. Children's books also focus less on natural environments today than they did 50 years ago.
Did You Know That is made possible by the USU Emma Eccles Jones College of Education and Human Services. More at cehs.usu.edu.
Thank you for listening to Utah Public Radio. This is Addison. Please check out our community calendar at upr.org, and you can find out local community events that you can take your family to.